Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 28, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be talking about medical monitoring in tort cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Happy to have with us today Mark Behrens. He is a partner at the Washington, D.C. law firm Shook, Hardy & Bacon. He's also the author of a piece on this topic earlier this week in the National Law Journal that I want to bring to your attention. And he's going to make some opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes on the topic. And then, as always, we'll be looking to you for your questions, so please be ready with your questions. And with that, Mr. Behrens, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. Thank you to the Federalist Society for giving me this opportunity, and thank you for the people that are joining our call and eventually podcast today. I'm going to be talking mainly about a decision that came out recently from the New York Court of Appeals, which is New York's highest court, on December 17th, 2013, called Caronia versus Philip Morris USA, Inc. I'll explain that case a little bit, and I'm going to also put the medical monitoring tort into a broader context in terms of how these decisions first developed and what the trends are and have been in the law today. The tort of medical monitoring seeks to recover for the cost of detecting the onset of disease. These are claims brought by people who are have no present physical injury, but are concerned that they've been exposed to a substance that may cause injury in the future. Over the last 30 years or so, medical monitoring claims have come in various contexts. They're all toxic tort type cases. They involve chemical exposures, lead exposures, cigarette smoke, various pharmaceuticals, and the like. And anyway, the first decision that really kicked off the notion that a plaintiff could recover for monitoring was a case called Friends for All Children versus Lockheed Aircraft Company from the D.C. Circuit in 1984. So this is a fairly recent tort. I mention this because it's widely cited as the case that launched the tort of medical monitoring, and because the panel at the time included Judges Abner Mikva and Judges Bork and Starr. And Judge Ken Starr wrote the opinion in the D.C. Circuit that started the notion of people suing because of fear of future conditions. After the Friends for All Children case, there were a number of decisions in the 80s and early 90s that looked at medical monitoring and awarded it with certain protections to make sure that it wouldn't be a free-for-all. For example, there are requirements the plaintiff have to have a reasonable concern that they need monitoring. And there were restraints put on how the monitoring would be conducted and how the awards would be handed out. That changed in the late 1990s in a couple of decisions, one called Bourgeois out of the Louisiana Supreme Court and one called Bauer out of the West Virginia Supreme Court. The Louisiana decision in 1998 and the Bauer decision in 1999 that opened up this tort and made it of a much larger concern because the courts had very porous standards for who could obtain monitoring. And in the West Virginia case, they said that the money could be awarded in lump sum to the plaintiffs with no guarantee that the money would ever even be spent on medical monitoring. One of the dissenting judges used to comment at the time that it was much more likely that people would take that award, particularly since they have no present injury and would use it to buy a new television set or a new vehicle or something like this. So there were concerns that this the money would not be used for the purposes for which it were. And at that same time, there was a case before the United States Supreme Court called Metro North versus Buckley that arose under FELA, the Federal Employees Liability Act, which is not a statute that governs lawsuits by federal employees. It is a loss. It is a worker comp substitute for railroad workers' injuries. Rose in an asbestos context of workers that had worked in Grand Central Station. They were covered with so much asbestos when they left work that they were called the snowmen of Grand Central. And because of their very massive exposures in the workplace to asbestos, they were concerned that they could contract cancer. The United States Supreme Court said that they would not recognize medical monitoring as a cause of action under FELA, and the court talked about concerns that it would result in a flood of claims coming forward, that it would clog the courts for people with serious injuries and deplete money that would be needed to pay cancer victims. After the Metro North decision came out, the pendulum swung very strongly against medical monitoring. Where there had been decisions earlier, as I explained, that had allowed it, after the Supreme Court's decision, almost uniformly the court said no. And there was a string of cases beginning in the year 2000 where Supreme Courts of Alabama, Kentucky, Michigan, Mississippi, Nevada, and Oregon had all said no to medical monitoring. There was a very strong trend against adoption of medical monitoring for the policy reasons outlined in the Supreme Court's Metro North opinion. But in very recent years, the pendulum looked like maybe it could swing back a little bit the other way. The highest courts of Missouri in 2007, Massachusetts in 2009, and Maryland in 2013 allowed medical monitoring in a few circumstances. So people were looking at the New York case as an important one, not only because New York is a very significant state that has a long history as a leader in the tort field. I think of the Paulsgraf decision going back to Justice Cardozo when we were all law students. But New York is an important state because of its influence in the area of tort law. And plaintiff's lawyers thought that they would win this case, the Coronia case, that is. Coronia then comes to the New York Court of Appeals with his background that the trend of uniform rejection of medical monitoring had begun to swing back a little bit. Plaintiff's lawyers were hopeful that they would get a pro-plaintiff court in New York and that this case would provide great momentum for letting the genie out of the bottle again in medical monitoring. And Coronia was a case involving longtime heavy smokers over the age of 50 who had not been diagnosed with lung cancer. So none of these plaintiffs had any present physical injury. They're all people who are longtime heavy smokers and had a fear that they might get cancer at some point. And so they sought a court-supervised program at the expense of Philip Morris. They would provide the plaintiffs low-dose CT scan, CAT scan, of the chest, which the plaintiffs claim would help them detect cancer in its early stages and hopefully be able to seek some treatment. The case was originally in the federal court system. The other tort claims were dismissed by the district court, affirmed by the Second Circuit, which affirmed dismissal of the plaintiff's negligence, strict liability, and breach of implied warranty claims, leaving the medical monitoring claim. The Second Circuit said, we're not sure what New York is in this area. There were decisions in lower courts and in the federal district courts that had recognized medical monitoring under New York law, but because of many decisions since 2000 saying no to medical monitoring, the Second Circuit thought that it would be best if the New York Court of Appeals was asked to decide for itself rather than speculate as to what New York law would be. And the New York Court of Appeals said that they would not recognize medical monitoring. And they reached that decision a couple of ways. One was they looked at the fundamental tort law requirement that a plaintiff must have a present physical injury. That has been a requirement that has long been recognized in tort law in New York and throughout the United States. And the medical monitoring cause of action for plaintiffs who are asymptomatic simply cannot be reconciled with that traditional tort law requirement. The court was also guided by the United States Supreme Court's concerns that were raised in the Metro North versus Buckley case back in 1997. And the New York Court of Appeals again said, we're concerned that dispensing with the physical injury requirement could permit tens of millions of potential plaintiffs to recover medical monitoring costs, effectively flooding the courts while also depleting the tortfeasor's resources for those who have actually sustained damages. So the court is not only concerned about violating a traditional tort rule, but the practical implications that doing so would have on the court system and on future plaintiffs in a variety of contexts who may come forward with serious diseases and in need of compensation. And then secondly, the court looked at this from the practical standpoint. Are courts well equipped to design and implement and monitor medical monitoring programs? And on this one, again, the court said, we're not the right body to do this. They said, we could do it. We have the authority to adopt medical monitoring, but we're not the right body to do that. And the court said, from a practical standpoint, it cannot be overlooked that there's no framework concerning how such a medical monitoring program would be implemented and administered. The court said that courts generally lack the technical expertise necessary to effectively administer these programs that are heavily dependent on scientific disciplines such as medicine, chemistry, and environmental science. And then the court concluded that the legislature is plainly in the better position to study the impact and the consequences of creating such a cause of action, including the cost of implementing and the burden of the courts in adjudicating these claims. And in addition to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Buckley, where they talk about that, the court also cited a Missouri Law Review article written by my colleague Victor Schwartz called Medical Monitoring, The Right Way and the Wrong Way, that came out in 70 Missouri Law Review 349 in the spring of 2005. And the court was guided by the discussion in that law review as to why medical monitoring may have some superficial appeal, but when you really get into how it fits with traditional tort law principles, the public policy implications of creating a situation where tens of millions of claims could come forward and jeopardize recoveries for future claimants that are more deserving, the court has said, no, we're not going to go down that path. This is a very significant decision, not only because of the strength of the opinion, the strength of the court's reasoning, but also, again, because there were a string of decisions beginning in 2000 that rejected medical monitoring, a little bit of wavering in the courts over the last couple of years, and I think that the New York court's decision now is a very strong one that I think will lead future courts that are asked whether to adopt medical monitoring to be more likely to join the camp of the overwhelming number of courts now that have said no to these claims since the year 2000. That's the context in which these claims have come up and the context in which the New York Court of Appeals reached its decision and a summary of the decision. And now I would be happy to answer any questions that people have about this tort or trends in this area.
Thank you very much. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Mark Behrens, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make a brief programming announcement. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., we'll be discussing yesterday's Supreme Court decision in the Sandifer case. That concerns compensation of employees for donning and doffing equipment at the beginning and ends of their shifts. It's a very significant case and a unanimous decision that we'll be discussing tomorrow at 1 p.m. And then on Thursday at 3 p.m., we'll be discussing college campus speech codes. So another significant matter to discuss on Thursday at 3 p.m. Today, of course, we're discussing medical monitoring with attorney Mark Behrens. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. And let me ask you, Mark, you've mentioned the medical, sort of the size of the pie argument. It's one of the two things the court seemed to focus on, the idea that medical monitoring might eat up resources and money available to other people who are already injured. I guess a lot of that arises from the asbestos industry cases when some of these companies had gone out of business and there were funds established and they had, certainly a finite amount of funds. I'm wondering if that's the origin of that sort of argument. Does it apply to businesses that are ongoing, that, you know, can continue to make profits and theoretically, at least in the eyes of some of the plaintiff's attorneys, continue to pay damages? Is that where it comes from, and does it apply to ongoing enterprises?
It does. It's a very good question. The Supreme Court's decision in Metro North Buckley was an asbestos case, and it's interesting in the New York Court of Appeals decision in Caronia that there was a dissent by two of the justices who said that they thought the concerns about a flood of claims were overblown and that the courts could handle this. But if you look at the history of the asbestos litigation, particularly going back about 10 years ago, the courts had been receptive of claims brought by people who had little or no physical impairment. Cases were being generated, 100,000 a year were being filed. They were being generated by mass screenings conducted by plaintiff's lawyers. Some of those have, the diagnosis in those has been called bogus by some courts, certainly questionable. And that created a situation where we saw there was a flood of claims when there was a very low barrier for the type of alleged injury that a plaintiff would have to have. It did produce the flood of claims that the New York Court of Appeals and the United States Supreme Court argued could happen. And we saw in that situation it did bankrupt companies. The flood of claims that came forward in the asbestos did contribute significantly to over 100 companies going bankrupt since the litigation has started, and that has jeopardized recoveries for people that have cancer. So there is a laboratory where we can look at the concerns raised by the New York Court of Appeals and look at the concerns raised by the United States Supreme Court, and we can see that it has happened. And the courts, because of that, have taken measures, courts and legislatures took measures to limit those types of claims, to say that asbestos cases can only go to trial if people have real physical impairment. But it's a very good question, and we've seen it happen in that context. It could certainly happen in others.
Once again, we're talking to Mark Behrens. Our lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And I'll ask another question while we're waiting to see if the audience comes to life here, Mark. Is there a threshold bad act or injurious behavior on the part of defendants here? Is it in those states that have medical monitoring, what sort of connection must there be, not to a present injury, but to some behavior on the part of the defendant in the first instance that might lead to an injury? You know, with asbestos, I suppose the link between that and mesothelioma and other injuries was pretty clear. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Another good question, Dean. The courts that have adopted medical monitoring, for the most part, have recognized that it is a type of claim that could be subject to abuse. If people don't have to have a physical injury, and because people are exposed on a daily basis to any number of things that one could say I need to be monitored for, there is certainly the potential for the courts to be clogged and defendant resources to be stressed by people who have nothing wrong with them. So the courts have tried to deal with that situation. I can just read to you some of the factors, for instance, that the Maryland Court of Appeals, that state's highest court, came out with in a case in 2013, where Maryland adopted medical monitoring, but they said to do it that a plaintiff would have to show significant exposure to a proven hazardous substance, and that as a result of that significant exposure, the plaintiff suffers a significantly increased risk of contracting a disease. So even in states like Maryland that have permitted this, you can't just say, I was exposed and I'm afraid. You have to show significant exposures that would lead to a person to have a legitimate concern that that level of exposure is one that is significantly increases risk of disease. So it's not enough in Maryland to say, I was exposed, I have a risk, and I'm concerned. You have to have a significant exposure. It has to be and significantly increased your risk of getting a disease. There has to be a finding that increased risk makes diagnostic medical examinations reasonably necessary, and that the monitoring and testing exists that would make the early treatment and early detection and treatment possible and beneficial. That's important too, because they're saying the test would have to do something. We're giving you, in Maryland, they say there has to be an early detection if the early detection will lead to the possibility of a treatment or a cure, which would suggest that if the early detection is not going to change the course of events in the disease, that medical monitoring then would not do any good, unfortunately for that person, and the courts are not going to award it. Other courts have said that if we're going to develop a program, that we're not going to pay people in lump sum, like West Virginia did, because it is so subject to abuse. Many commentators have said, and courts, that if you take a person who is healthy today and give them a lump sum payment, the notion that most people are going to carefully hoard that award and save it for a disease that they're not likely to ever get is very remote. Most people instead would take that lump sum payment and use it to pay everyday living expenses. And that's what has happened in West Virginia. So courts recognizing that potential for abuse when they do allow medical monitoring, most say it's got to be done through a court-administered fund so that there is some protection that the money that is being handed out is actually being used for the purpose for which it is being awarded.
If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Are any of these cases, Mark, teed up to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, or does that seem unlikely?
Unlikely right now, because most of these are arising under state tort law. So there would not be a federal issue that would get you to the U.S. Supreme Court in most of these cases. The exceptions would be if a federal statute was at issue, like in the Metro North case, because that arose under FELA. But the court was very clear in that case in saying that there would not be an award for somebody who was asymptomatic and had no present physical injury. It would have to be in that type of context, but the strength of the court's opinion and the near uniformity of state law decisions since then make it unlikely that I think the Supreme Court would revisit their position on that issue.
All right. Again, push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. Let me ask you, since it is a matter of state law, and there's at least a fair amount of activity in different states in terms of tort reform, are there efforts legislatively in any of these states to rein in or at least define the parameters of medical monitoring?
Not this session. That is something that people have looked at in the past, particularly in West Virginia. I'm not aware of any legislative reforms right now. The courts themselves have been very good at recognizing the potential for abuse in these claims and either saying no to medical monitoring or taking steps to eliminate those abuses. And also, when they've occurred, there has been reversal by the courts. New Jersey was one of the first courts to adopt medical monitoring. They have since moved to limit its application. I mentioned that Missouri was one of the states that recently, in 2007, being recent, adopted medical monitoring in a case involving children exposed to lead from a smelter that was in their area. There have been subsequent cases saying it's limited to those types of situations and should not be applied in the product liability context. So we have seen courts that when they've gone, they've recognized that there are problems with this type of tort and have either tried to limit it to restrict those problems or have changed course or sharply limited the context in which medical monitoring awards can take place.
All right. You mentioned that this was a fairly highly watched case, a carefully followed case. How deflating is this result going to be for the plaintiff, the trial bar? Are they going to shift tactics here, or are they going to keep pressing one state after another, pressing this issue? Do you have any sense of that? I'm asking you to predict the future here, but
I think that they are very deflated with this decision because there had been some recent decisions. The Massachusetts case in 2009 was a smoker case similar to this one. The plaintiff's bar had a good ruling in that one. The Oregon Supreme Court in a similar case had gone the other way. But there was a Massachusetts case fairly recent in New York. The federal courts and lower court opinions had recognized medical monitoring in certain circumstances. So there was some notion that this was as accepted in the New York court system. And because New York is a significant court, the plaintiff's bar thought that they would win this case and that they would take this opinion and then run with it. And that's not going to happen now. They were surprised by this. And the fact that New York has decided to join the very strong line of other decisions since 2000 rejecting medical monitoring, I think will be very influential on whether other courts do this. But the plaintiff's bar is looking to bring more claims based on people who are not injured. The fact that somebody has to have a physical injury is a limitation on how many lawsuits can be filed. We see it in the asbestos context, where the plaintiffs have had to show a present physical impairment that has sharply limited the number of cases that get filed annually. The asbestos litigation is now focused on the cancer cases. Very significant cases. They are expensive with a lot of exposure, but were nowhere near the days where there were 100,000 cases a year being filed. So their nirvana would be able to bring more claims based on people who have no present physical injury, where there is no, where the universe of potential plaintiffs, potential clients would be virtually infinite, and the New York Court of Appeals decision is an important step in preventing that from happening.
Any other cases headed to other state Supreme Courts that you're aware of just like this New York case. This is going to be the next test case in another significant state.
This was the most recent case that I was aware of that had been teed up. The Maryland decision was at the end of 2013, and then there was this case in New York. I'm sure there will be other cases. I suspect that the plaintiff's lawyers in particular will focus on states where they believe that they have a litigation advantage. If you look at particularly the Missouri Supreme Court, the Massachusetts Supreme Court, those are courts that have shown a willingness in recent years to expand tort liabilities. The plaintiffs are not looking at moderate or conservative courts to do this. They're looking at courts that are activist courts. They were hoping New York would join that list. It didn't happen, but they will continue to look for opportunities, particularly among courts that have an activist reputation, to find those that are willing to reject the reasoning of the Supreme Court, reject the reasoning of most other courts, to simply find a way to award money to people who are not sick.
Well, let me make a final call for question here. If you have a question for Mark Behrens, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Seeing none, Mark, let me. We've got some time left. Let me come back to you and see if you have any final thoughts or if you want to wrap up before we adjourn the call.
No, this is, I guess, in a broader trend. This the plaintiff's bar is very interested in finding ways to expand the universe of potential plaintiffs, particularly for people who have no injury. Medical monitoring is one way that they're doing it. You also see it in Consumer Protection Act claims where people are suing, let's say, food manufacturers, not because they have any present injury, but because they say they were misrepresented, that the product was labeled natural or low fat or something like this. This type of claim is something that the plaintiff's bar is continuing to work on. Civil justice organizations at the national and state levels are monitoring these developments very closely and looking for opportunities in cases such as the case in New York on medical monitoring to educate the courts that there are very real policy considerations with what the plaintiffs are asking them to do, and that the better course is to follow traditional tort law principles and do what is in the best interest of people with serious and legitimate claims, and not look for ways to pay people who have nothing wrong with them.
Well, this is fascinating information. I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you, Mark Behrens. And I also want to thank our audience for joining the call today and remind you that our next call is scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be discussing yesterday's important Supreme Court decision. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.